The question was asked, when we look at the Torah, so it's hard for us to understand anything in the Torah without the oral tradition, which means that by default there's a certain amount of trust we're going to have to put into Moshe Rabbeinu or the oral tradition. And then comes the question, how definitive is our understanding of the Torah? If it's all going based on Moshe Rabbeinu, his tradition, his understanding, etc. Again, in fact, this deserves a series and not a quick answer. But let's explore a few angles of the concepts we're discussing. And perhaps with that, we will have a better understanding of the system and its validity. You'll notice that the Torah is very careful to clarify that Moshe is not on Sinai when the Torah is being given. The Medrash even has a funny comment. The Medrash says Moshe wanted to be closer to Hashem at the time that Hashem said the Ten Commandments. And Hashem said to him, Moshe, go see if the people are coming up the mountain. And Moshe said, I already told them not to come up the mountain. Of course they're not coming up the mountain. And God says to Moshe, go remind them. So Moshe, he gets instructions, he goes down to remind them. As he's down there reminding them, hey, remember, you're not allowed to go up the mountain, Hashem begins the Ten Commandments, so to speak. He can't be on top of the mountain. It has to be very clear that Moshe's on bottom and Hashem is giving the Torah from the top, and he's not there. That's what the Medrash says, yeah. So, again, in the text, it's clear that Moshe was on bottom, but this idea that there was a conversation where Hashem's intention was, Moshe, it has to be clear, you're not up here when I'm talking, that's not clear in the verses. So, on the one hand, we see a very clear message in the Torah that Hashem is true, and Moshe's role is as an emissary. And yet, when the Torah begins the Jewish people's relationship with the Ribon Shel Olam, so the Torah repeatedly stresses, Vayaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe avdo. They believed Hashem and Moshe. We say on Shabbos morning, Yismach Moshe b'matanat chelko, ki eved ne'eman karata lo. You called him a trusted servant. And one of the most important points of the Torah is the trustworthiness of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's why Moshe had to be the poorest Jew for the first period of the Exodus from Egypt, where everyone had more money than him. When we left Egypt, Moshe was the poorest. Everyone else had a lot of wealth. What? How do we know that? It says that Moshe Rabbeinu came into Egypt with a donkey for his wife and kids and himself. So ordinarily you cross the desert with a camel. So our sages say he came in with a donkey because he had nothing else. He had one donkey for his whole family. Our sages say that that is the reference to the Messiah coming in on a donkey to tell us that just as Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't into the material world, so too the Mashiach is going to be one who is separated from the material world. And when we left Egypt, so our sages point out, everyone was in pursuit of wealth. They were told, go ask the Egyptians for their wealth as you leave. And it says Moshe Rabbeinu was busy looking for the mitzvah, for Yosef's tomb, to take Yosef's bones to maintain the promise. So the Talmud says in Tractate Sota that while everyone else was getting wealthy leaving Egypt, Moshe was busy looking for Yosef's bones. So then you just do 1 plus 1 equals 2. He walks into Egypt, poor. He walks out of Egypt, where everyone else made money, he was busy making mitzvos. So then they all became wealthy, and he remained status quo. So then he remains the poorest Jew. Everyone else had opportunity to get wealth. They cross the Yam Suf, and the bodies of the Egyptians float onto the shore, and it says the Jews go and plunder the bodies to take off their gold and silver and jewelry that they took to war. Moshe is not there. On the contrary, Vayasa Moshe. Moshe tells the Jews, hey, leave all that, let's go. So everyone else is collecting wealth, and again, Moshe is not there. So then when everyone else gets wealthy twice, Moshe was not involved. So that certainly seems to indicate that anyone who wanted money got money, except Moshe. Moshe wasn't interested. Now that's a very, very important point, the idea that Moshe wasn't into the materialistic world. Our sages say that when Korach challenged Moshe's authenticity, so then Moshe said to their Bon Shalom, you have to do a miracle and show that he's lying. And if you don't, so then I'm out. I don't want to continue. When Moshe was first told he should lead the Jewish people out of Egypt and Hashem will give them a Torah, so Moshe says, I don't want to go. Maimonides explains, why didn't Moshe want to go? Moshe said, if I do miracles, so then a miracle worker will come later and do another miracle. Moshe said, if people will trust you, Hashem, and trust me as being your emissary, by virtue of a miracle, I don't want to be the leader. I don't want it. That's something which you always have to wonder. Maybe he pulled a fast one on me. So I don't want people to trust me because I did a miracle. So that's why Hashem finally tells him, no, you're standing here on Sinai. You're standing here by the burning bush, Sneh, that's why it's called Sinai. On this mountain, I will bring the Jewish people and I will reveal myself to them. They won't have to trust you. When they give over their tradition to their kids, they're going to say, son, this is what my father told me, that his father told him, that we all stood at Sinai and we all saw it. So then they won't say Hashem is our God because Moshe told us. On the contrary, they will all join you in testifying that I am the God. And that's only then does Moshe agree to take on the job. Only after Hashem promises him that the Jewish people will personally witness what prophecy is, they won't have to trust to take Moshe's word for it. So the question is a good question. But we have answers to the question as far as where we had validity to the authenticity of what Moshe was saying. And this is a concept that is revisited over and over again in our sages, in the Talmud and in the Medrash. That's why Moshe is called Ne'eman, as we say in the prayer. He is the trusted one. V'chol beiti ne'eman hu, Hashem himself says in the Torah. You can trust him about anything that's going on in my house. So that's point number one, that if we would have the time, we would explore where the Torah says it and where you see it in the Torah. And I gave a few quick examples, but really this deserves a series. We would explore, number one is Moshe's validity as a human being, what the Torah tells us that gives us room to trust Moshe. That's point one, which needs more expansion. Point two is an understanding of the laws of derivation Moshe gave us. Meaning, we have to understand where was Moshe coming from when Moshe said whatever he said. Moshe made institutions. Where does all the oral tradition or the rabbinic institutions come from? And point three, which again we won't have the time to go into at length, but you can see in, I think, the seventh speech of the Drashos Aran, which we learn on Friday mornings, the Ran discusses this idea of which is also discussed by Maimonides, which is also discussed by the Talmud. What was the Torah's intent? What was Hashem's intent? We would like to think that when Hashem gave us the Torah, he had a specific meaning. Let's take an example that's inaccurate, but it'll serve our purpose. Are you allowed to eat kitnios on Pesach or not? What does God want? It's either yes or no. Either all Ashkenazim are right and Sephardim are doomed, or all Sephardim are right and Ashkenazim are suffering in life. Right? That's how we'd like to think the Torah works. And our sages had a tradition that it does not work that way. And this tradition is, again, something which we find over and over again in the Talmud. That Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim hem, that within the Torah Hashem made a capacity for multiple interpretations. And Hashem said, you, the human beings, the high court, the rabbis who have studied it long enough will come to a conclusion as to how to interpret this. I'm not going to define it for you. Hashem says, you have a holiday of Sukkot. The first day, don't do any task. The last day, don't do any task. What about the days in between? You can, but you can't. That's what the Torah says. In one place the Torah says you may do tasks, and another place the Torah says you have a whole 8-day long holiday. Well, which one is it? So our tradition is the Torah purposely left it open. The Torah said, I want you to know that certain things are prohibited, certain things are permissible, the rabbis will decide. I'm not saying which. I'm not going to define it. I'm going to leave it open. The Torah says when you have a non-kosher animal, you may sell it to a non-Jew. The Torah says when you have a non-kosher animal, you may not do business in non-kosher food. Well, which one is it? You just told me I may sell it, and now you told me I can't. Right? I'm leaving it to the rabbis to define it. When may I sell non-kosher food? When may I not sell non-kosher food? So this is a recurring theme in the Torah. This is a recurring theme in the interpretations of Chazal. Not everything was given open shut. The Torah says when you have a Yom Tiv, so it should be a day dedicated to holiness. The Torah says when you have a Yom Tiv, it should be a day dedicated to pleasure, to enjoying yourself. Which one is it? Am I supposed to spend the whole day studying Torah and praying in shul? Am I supposed to spend the whole day sleeping late, having steak, drinking wine, sleeping again? What am I supposed to do? Is it a day of spirituality? Is it a day of physicality? Well, what's the day all about? One verse says this way, the other verse says that way. Right, I left it up to the rabbis to decide. So this idea that what the rabbis say, is it finite or is it not finite? If we understand it as a living Torah, where Hashem said the rabbis of the generation will have certain things that they have to decide on, and I'm not going to call the shots on them. So then I can understand that if this is what they decided, it's right. Whichever way they decided, they're right. Now this concept is illustrated most potently in the story of Rabbi Eliezer and Tanur Shel Achnai. You know the story? Okay, so Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos, what? Right. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos was 28 years old. He hadn't yet learned any Torah. And then he ran away from home and he started learning by the chief rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We're talking about the period at the end of the Second Temple. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is going to be the prince leading us into the period of exile, the destruction of the Second Temple. So prior to the destruction, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos heads out to Jerusalem. He studies under Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and finally becomes a top disciple of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And he has four contemporaries. We studied in Pirkei Avos. There were five top students to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The other four were tremendous heavyweights as well. Heavyweights in halacha, right? Rabbi Yeshua. Yeah, Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanos is asked the following question. You have an earthenware oven. It becomes spiritually defiled. One of the eight vermin die inside or fall inside when they're dead. Or it's in a tent with a corpse. So it becomes tame, spiritually defiled. If you break it in half, so you have to imagine something that goes the shape of a teepee. If you break it in half, so the bigger half can still be used as an oven, so the bigger half is still defiled. If you break it in half again, so now you have three teepees, yes, one on top of the other. Imagine three tires, one on top of the other. So then being that you broke it in half, and then you took the bigger half and broke that in half, so now you've basically broken any usage of this oven, and it is no longer spiritually defiled. If you reattach it, so then it becomes defiled again. What happens if instead you take it, you slice it into three slices, so now it looks, let's say, like three tires lying one on top of the other, only each one is slightly more narrow, and you put sand in between each layer. So now you have a layer that's like a tire and sand, and then another layer that's like a slightly smaller tire and sand again, and then a final layer. And then you put pitch or tar all around it. So you've recreated it, but you haven't recreated it because you've recreated it in a broken form. You haven't reattached the pieces. So is that type of oven, is it defiled or is it pure? Now that oven is called Tanur Shel Achnai, the oven that's like a snake. Achnai is a snake because just like a snake coils itself around. You guys ever see snakes can do that? They have a broad base, they have a broad circle and then smaller consecutive circles. So too, that's what you've done with this oven. You have the broad base and then you have a slightly smaller circle of sand and then another piece of the oven, etc. So they asked Rabbi Eliezer, is this oven pure or defiled? Rabbi Eliezer said, it's pure. Tameh. Yeah. They asked the rabbis. The rabbis said, it is tameh, it is defiled. They called in Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Eliezer said, well, if I'm right, then the tree that's growing over here will jump back 50 feet, and the tree jumps out of its place and goes back 50 feet. He says, if I'm right, then the stream that's flowing down here will flow backwards, and the stream starts flowing backwards. If I'm right, then anytime, every proof he brings, they tell him that doesn't prove anything. The tree, we don't bring proof from trees. The stream, we don't bring proof from streams. He says, if I'm right, the walls of the academy will cave in, and the walls of the academy start caving in. And then a heavenly voice comes out and says, why are you arguing with him? He's right. So the head of the court stands up on his feet and says, God, you told us that we have to define the Torah based on our understanding, based on the tradition you gave us. You said, Lo vashamayimi, at the end of the Torah, you said, Torah is no longer in heaven. I've given it to you. I've given you the rules. Define it the way I've taught you. But then you define it. So even though you're telling us one way, but we have to go with the rules you gave us. And the rules you gave us are that we will go based on our understanding of the laws you taught us. And Hashem says, you're right. Well, wait a second. Who knows best? Hashem says that Rabbi Eliezer's right. So why didn't the rabbis just say, okay, I guess we didn't understand. Okay, Hashem, you're telling us we were wrong. So obviously we're wrong. That's not what they said. So that takes a lot of gall. If the understanding of Torah is that there's one right understanding, one correct interpretation, so then if a heavenly voice comes out and says, hey, he's right, buddies, so then all the rabbis should bow down and say, you are the master. But they didn't. They said, you taught us laws of derivation, and according to the laws of derivation and our human understanding, we have come to this conclusion. We can't fold. Lo vashamayimi, you told us it's no longer in heaven. So that opens us to this understanding. This is all quoted in Talmud. I mean, what I said until now is from Talmud. This opens us to the understanding that there are multiple interpretations to the Torah that are true. How does that work? So that deserves a long class about the laws of derivation and the idea that built into the laws of derivation was multiplicity. That Hashem says there are dual meanings and dual possibilities of interpretation. Our tradition is that there are 98 possible interpretations to any law. 98 valid.
Why do we take the interpretation that has the stringency of what we have now?
Who said we took on stringencies? If you look at, the more you'll learn, the more leniencies you'll see.
Okay, well, they're lenient in a way, and they're stringent in a way.